G-by-E-by-M, and I do have geneticists just like Brian who come back and say, well, why are you bastardizing G-by-E by putting M into it? It's been perfectly fine all until this time, and you guys keep screwing it up. In reality, producers identify a lot more when we put a G-by-E-by-M in it, because as I tell them, think about management as what you oversee, environment is what you're overcoming, because genetics is what you're optimizing. And when you explain it to them that way, they go, makes perfect sense. Why haven't you guys been doing that forever? So it's really a piece of this. And what why Brian came to me and we talked about this was that I've done a lot of work on G by E by M, but also we've done a lot of work on the yield gap. What causes that aspect? And so I'm just going to give you kind of a tutorial and aspects of really what's happening on the yield gap as we begin to look at these dynamics. Brian mentioned this before, but we talk about yield gaps as the actual yield relative to yield that's unlimited by either water or nutrients, so you can think about genetic potential in that. The question remains, however, is what can be done to close that yield gap? How much can be done in terms of either getting those genetic potentials realized or getting management practices to fit into that aspect and other different things? And if I go back, and I'll give a credit to Bill Ron for what was done with the whole aspects of fertilizer management relative to showing just how important it was to start thinking about when we apply those nutrients at various times in that part of the season that was really critical to that. And I think that this is not only for wheat, but all of our agronomic crops, is we need to stand back and say, what does this yield gap really mean, and where are we at in terms of this? If you look at the book by Fisher et al., and you look at their chapter on wheat, you begin to see that, farm yields have increased. They're on wheat around the world. It's about 0.3% per year. The potential yield is increasing about 0.6% a year, but there's no difference between dry versus humid climates or spring versus wheat. That's been sort of the genetic trend that we've had going up there. The average yield gap around the world is about 48%. That's a fairly large number when you think about it from that standpoint. They do appear to be closing slowly. They're not rapidly closing. It says that we have a lot of opportunity in there. And we can think about increasing our potential yield, increasing grain number, increasing the harvest index, increasing grain weight or total dry matter. All of those different pieces are there. So this is not a case in which there is a single factor, say, well, if we chase this, this is going to close the yield gap. We have many opportunities. And in a lot of our experiments, where I think we need to be going back to, and I'll put this in right now, is that we need to go back and start making sure that we're looking at yield components. What really is being affected in that system throughout time? Is it number of ears per meter squared, or is it number of kernels per ear out there, or is it weight per kernel? All those different yield components, and where is that affected during the season as well? Because we begin to see those dynamics in all of this. So the yield gaps, and we've spent a lot of time on this, looking at these dynamics. I'm just going to work you through this. I just pulled out the Australian data off of FAO in there. And what we do in looking at yield gaps is that we don't go to the genetic potential. We go to a thing we call attainable yield. We just statistically fit through the upper frontier of all the data there and then compute the yield gap as that difference between the observed yield on a given year and that line that's there. And so there's a yield on the left side, yield gap on the right side. You guys, Gary, have got a lot of things to do yet in Australia, and it's really important in all of this to say, where are we at in these dynamics? But more importantly, what's the characteristics of those years that are on that frontier line as well? What are the important pieces of that? Here's Canada. That 2016 year, he was pretty good in terms of this, and it kind of really messes the lineup, and you see all these different things. But, you know, you look at Canada as much lower numbers in terms of the yield gap than is Australia in terms of the dynamics that are going on. And if you just look at this ratio of actual to obtainable yield, that's a different way. And now you begin to see that you have years, obviously, that you've got no yield gap because they have to be defined that way by our definition. But you got all the way down to 60% yield gap, only 40% of attainable. Canada's a much narrower range on this, again, because of the growing conditions it's being subjected to from that standpoint. Mexico, and this again is FAO stat data. You just look at the trends that are up there, and the trend in Mexico is because there's been a lot of addition of irrigated wheat into that as well. So relieved a lot of the water stress that's occurring. But then it really got to the point of when you start looking at these yield gaps, there's a question of scale. There's a question of scale because country averages in terms of this relative to state averages, county averages, things like this. So I just plotted out national winter wheat yields versus Kansas winter wheat yields. It's probably an unfair comparison because Kansas dominates in winter wheat production, but you begin to see there's a lot more scatter in Kansas than there is in the national yield as well. If we begin to bring it down even more, I took Kansas wheat yields and then I just plotted two different counties out of Kansas. So when we really get down to looking at yield gaps relative to where the producer is going to be asked questions, we've really got to get it down to a scale in which they can identify with. And at probably the county level, number of different, the finest scale we can get to, they get become much more cognizant of the management factors that are relatable to them. Statewide averages, it's kind of get glossy-eyed in that. They do have an issue. They do have utility, but it doesn't really fit there. We spent a lot of time looking at this. Switch back to a different crop to show you a different dynamic because one of the questions is how's the environment fit into this, and this is an intersection between the two of these, and this, we haven't done this for wheat, we've done it for soybeans. This is three different states that we've looked at: Kentucky, Iowa, and Nebraska relative to soybean yields. These are plotted average county yields. Each one of this is the average of 40 years of average county yields plotted against the National Crop Commodity Productivity Index. It's basically an index that's on the quality of the soils that are there. So the higher the average county yield, the better the soils. Zero NCCPI index is a parking lot. One is a really high quality soil. And you get really poor quality soils in Kentucky, you're going to have low average county yields just because they don't have the water to support it, they don't have the fertility to support it. You can ask what's wrong with Nebraska, and that's because we only picked irrigated counties in Nebraska. And so if you can supply water when that plant needs it, the quality of the soil doesn't become as important. But if you're relying on natural rainfall, the quality of the soil is all important from that standpoint. We saw the same thing with maize yields. And we began to use this for producers to show them that if we look at the NCCPI across the Midwestern United States, the Corn Belt is defined for a very specific region. And reason is the fact that that does have those high quality soils. And we see differences in yield gaps in there. As we move crops and we change mega environments, we're going to be moving it into soils that don't have the capacity to support high yields and are going to be much more subjected to the weather variation each year. So we begin to see the weather dynamic of what's going on and how it all fits together. I spent a lot of time in the Great Plains looking at Kansas and Oklahoma wheat yields because they became very fascinating. I told Dave that I had a really good story going until 2016, because if you look at those yield trend lines, from about 2000 to 2015, Kansas and Oklahoma wheat yields were declining. We were blaming that on increasing temperatures and all the variation of climate. In 2016, it had record yields in both those states and all of this. These yields were actually declining at about 60 kilograms per hectare per year up until 2016. Very dramatic in terms of this, and looking at the shift of the wheat belt northward, which we projected with a lot of the climate piece. 2016, with that point on there, really messed that up, but it gave us another opportunity to look at this. So we're spending time on yield gaps across this. If you look at long term on Oklahoma, it's been relatively flat in terms of a lot of the obtainable yields. Large yield gaps, Kansas has been growing, North Dakota has been growing as well in terms of yield. But we've also been looking at the trends in these yield gaps. Kansas, there's really been no significant trend in closing the yield gap, either in Kansas, Oklahoma, and I put Kentucky in there because we're seeing a shift from corn production into wheat production in Kentucky, and a lot of different viewpoints, but there's still that trend. It runs about 20% of yield gap or 20% loss in it. Getting back to this G by E by M in terms of this, you know, we're not going to control the weather. But we are going to control the capacity of our soils to absorb water, store water, cycle nutrients. And I think we need to understand that soils is part of the environment that we need to think about managing from that standpoint. The cultural management that goes with that in terms of weed control, all the different things that go with the agronomic piece, genetics in terms of what we optimize from that standpoint. If we look at this, and go back to that Kansas, Oklahoma, North Dakota example, is that when we analyzed the yield gaps, is that basically the dominant factor was rainfall patterns during the grain filling period. We've seen other places in which we might have some temperature impact, but over the statewide average, it's really the precipitation piece. You get down at the county level, and even lower, we can start looking at the temperature impacts. Oklahoma, the dominant factor was variations in April rainfall. That's really at the onset. Kansas, so we're a little just farther north, it's variations in May rainfall. And if you move up to North Dakota, which is later, it's variations in that June-July rainfall. That's the dominant factor that's influencing the yield gap in all of this in terms of the dynamics. Trends in climate, temperature is going to be a factor long term that we need to be aware of. It's temperature extremes during flowering, cold and hot. And I'll just show you, because we just simulated normal conditions using the last 30 years for Salina, Kansas, the heart of Kansas in terms of the wheat belt. And then I added 3 degrees centigrade to that. And this is kernels per plant. In all of this is done in our rhizotrons, and then we put it under 3 different moisture regimes, 125% of field capacity, and 75% of field capacity. You can have it too wet and reduce kernels per plant. 2 is the field capacity, and then we reduce when we get water stress. We add that 3 degrees centigrade to it, and the kernels per plant are dramatically decreased in all cases in that standpoint. So we've done this on wheat from that standpoint. Question is, if we want to close this yield gap, how do we increase the efficiency of capturing precipitation in the soil? Can we increase water use efficiency in a crop that's typically growing under rain-fed conditions? And it really becomes the issue of how we manage soil. Precipitation is not the only limiting factor. There's temperature that we need to understand. We've got frost conditions, we've got high temperatures from all of this standpoint. So the challenge is, we really think about this yield gap and this expert working group that we have, it really becomes an integrated effort. We're going to have combinations between geneticists, agronomists, plant pathologists, entomologists, meteorologists, to evaluate yield responses and genetic diversity. If we're going to close the yield gap, it's not something we can just say, here's one discipline that's going to solve this. This is going to take a community effort, and that's why we formed it this way. I'm a big fan of looking at how do we learn and glean from yield trials across multiple locations in this yield gap response. How do we design some experiments that allows us to look at this, carefully looking at some of these responses. It doesn't have to be all run the same, but we need to get the same parameters to start being able to look at some of these pieces. And I think we have around the world in this community that we have the capability of being able to address some of those questions very quickly, bring some things together to really set the stage of where we're going. So with that, I'll stop, answer any questions that you have from that standpoint. So.